This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Well, now we're going to turn to a slightly more upbeat topic. This morning on Locus Focus, we celebrate Earth Day in the company of our four-legged best friends. When nature writer Ted Carasotti was ready for a new puppy, he wanted to find out how it was possible to give his new dog the longest and healthiest life possible. Traveling the world and interviewing breeders, veterinarians, and leaders of the animal welfare movement, he's pulled together the latest research in his new book, Pukka's Promise, The Quest for Longer-Lived Dogs, to help us rethink the everyday choices we make for our furry companions. This morning, Ted joins us, along with my dog, Karina, who's been here at the station ever since she was about 8 weeks old, joining me every week for the show. And we're going to talk about how raising a dog with consciousness is an environmental issue. Ted, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks very much, Barbara, for having me on the show, and thanks, Karina, too.
Yes, well, she actually chose you as the guest, so because I don't generally do dog shows, but since Karina's been accompanying me since she was a puppy on this show, and she's a very good silent program host, as opposed to my last dog, who I couldn't bring because she barked every time anybody walked near her, so she was not a good radio dog. But anyway, let's start by talking about the title of your book, or the subtitle, The Quest for Longer-Lived Dogs. What is that all about?
Well, I think as many of us who have lived with dogs realize pretty soon is that they don't live as long as we do. And when we fall in love with this member of another species, it seems criminal that they only live 10 or 15 years. And so when I published a book about my previous dog, Merle, Merle's Door, Lessons from a Free-Thinking Dog, I was heartbroken when he passed away at 14 years old. Many readers who read that book wrote me emails and said, why do our dogs have to die so young? In particular, why did my dog die of cancer at 2 years old, three, four, five? Why did five of my golden retrievers die of cancer? And I began to think, well, gosh, why do our dogs live such short lives, especially when we compare them to other species, horses, for example, or grizzly bears, or parrots, or tortoises? Why don't dogs live as long as elephants? And so I began to research the factors that influence canine longevity and how we might improve the breeding and care of our dogs so we could give them longer lives.
Well, actually, there seems to be two issues here. One, you said that your last dog, Merle, lived to be 14, and that's about how old my last two dogs have lived to be. And actually, 14, 15 is considered a pretty good old age for a medium to large-sized dog. Then the other part of the issue is, and this has been an experience a lot of my neighbors for, you know, unbeknown reasons in the last few years, several dogs on my block have died from cancer at age 3, 4, 5 years old, and which is really heartbreaking. But I want to first talk about why dogs, even if they live out their full lifespan, why it's so short. And I guess as a little preview for a show that's coming up in a few weeks, I'm reading a book right now about wolves, which is really fascinating. And it was really interesting to start reading that book after finishing reading Pukka's Promise. And wolves, and you mentioned in the book, have actually pretty short lifespans too. So what is it about the species itself that limits their ability to live past 14 or 15 years compared to a cat who can live sometimes to be 21 or 25?
Right. What I discovered when I started looking at the evolutionary history of dogs is that they are still genetically gray wolf. They share 99.9% of the gray wolf's DNA. And because the wolf's life is quite dangerous, it takes down bigger animals than itself with nothing more than its mouth. It protects its territory from other wolf packs. It lives in dangerous environments. It has to ford rivers, swim rivers. It's killed in avalanches. Those wolves, during evolutionary times, who had a predisposition to breed early and reach sexual maturity early, passed on their genes, whereas those wolves who delayed reproduction did not. And thus, the lifespan of wolves was shifted to a shorter lifespan and producing many pups because many of them wouldn't survive to maturity. Our dogs have inherited that fateful, if you will, genetic legacy, but then how we breed and care for them can either shorten that already naturally brief lifespan or extend it a little bit.
So one of the things I found interesting in your book, and I would say I'll start out by saying that I would agree with at least 90-95% of what you write, some of it which is maybe considered somewhat controversial, but there's two issues that I questioned, and we'll get into the really controversial one in a little bit. But the first one that I found kind of interesting was your belief that we're better off, if we want to have a longer-lived dog, getting a purebred dog and knowing the breeder than doing what I've done and a lot of people have done and you've done too, which is to do, get a rescue dog and you have no idea what the breed is or what the history of the dog is. Right. And we're sort of then, and sometimes these dogs also have like all kinds of traumas before you get them that you have to be coping with. And yet, I mean, I've been successful with my last two dogs in having them live out their full lifespan. And they were, well, one of them I actually knew the parents, but they were, both of the dogs were mutts.
Right. And I guess to clarify that a little bit, I've never said that purebred dogs live longer than mixed breed dogs. In fact, I cite the data from the veterinary literature that shows that mixed breed dogs, on average, live 1.8 years longer than a purebred of equivalent weight. However, you bring up some very good points, which I also brought up in the book, is that most often when we get a dog from a shelter, we don't know the history of its parents, what they died from, how long they lived. And therefore, if one wanted to hedge one's bets a little bit, one could look for a purebred dog and do a very good job of vetting its bloodlines to pick a dog who came from long-lived parents and grandparents and whose breeder had conscientiously gone out to breed a healthy, longer-lived dog, gave both parents the DNA tests that are applicable for the breed to make sure that the puppies are not going to get many of these genetically transmitted diseases that purebred dogs do, in fact, suffer from.
I was thinking about the first dog that I had, and I knew the parents, both the dog's parents and then the owners were friends of mine, and about, oh, I don't know, 6 months, a year after I got this dog, and she was about 6 months old when I got her, I moved in with the dog's father and the father's owner, and I was watching that dog, the older dog, one night just kind of chewing himself up, on chewing the backs of his legs, and just like obviously major skin issues. And at the time, it didn't occur to me that that was a genetic issue I should have been concerned about. And sure enough, when my dog was about 2 years old, she became a really serious self-biter, and then it occurred to me that this is something I should have really been aware of once I saw that her father had this issue. So I think we've learned a lot, and that was back in 1977, 78. We've learned a lot about all kinds of issues about canine health and genetics and stuff like that. But with that kind of lesson in mind, how would you suggest that somebody go about trying to find the healthiest dog possible when they're looking for a puppy?
Well, I would say that first, to pay attention to what one's heart and morals are saying, and that one, if one truly wants to get a dog from a shelter, to try and fall in love, if that's possible, with a dog that has reasonable conformation, that has a long snout, that has longish legs, because short-faced dogs do have many breathing problems. Longer body dogs with short legs, like Basset Hounds or Dachshunds, can have back problems. So if one goes to a shelter and one is trying to hedge one's bets again, it would be best to try and get a dog that had the conformation of, say, a naturally looking wolf. Then if one has one's heart on a particular purebred dog, again, getting a short-faced dog like a Pekingese or a pug or a bulldog, one is leaving oneself open for problems down the road. If you get a dog that has good conformation, that hasn't been bred for exaggerated anatomical features, it's really important to visit the kennel where that dog was bred to see what conditions the pups are raised in and socialized, and also to make sure that the breeder has conducted all the DNA tests that we just spoke about, which can prevent some common diseases that are tragic, like progressive retinal atrophy that makes dogs go blind, or central nuclear myopathy, a muscle-wasting disease. Diseases that are absolutely preventable by giving both parent dogs a simple DNA test with a cheek swab or a blood draw. So I would advise people to do the extra homework. And one final step one can do is use a software program that you can download from the internet to calculate the coefficient of inbreeding of your particular litter. And this way you can determine how inbred those puppies are going to be. Coefficients of inbreeding go from 0 to 100%. And more progressive breeders are saying that we should keep coefficients of inbreeding below 6% to prevent a lot of these diseases that come from using many common closely related ancestors in the breeding of dogs.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Ted Carasotti. He's author of a book called Pucca's Promise, The Quest for Longer-Lived Dogs. And we're talking this morning about actually some of the environmental concerns that we face raising our dogs, things that we probably didn't think about very much many years ago, whether it's what the dog is eating or the kind of environment that the dog is living in. And we're going to get to some of that in a little bit. But I want to pick up from where you're just talking about, Ted, about the issues about breeding. You have very few illustrations in your book, but there's one that you have I found really kind of disconcerting when I started to look at it closely, because it's showing what the original breed for the original German Shepherd looked like before it was bred for a certain look that made it almost impossible for the dog to walk. So I want to focus on two breeds that have are notorious for health issues and go into the reasons why they were bred that way. Let's first talk about German Shepherds and then talk about Golden Retrievers.
Okay.
So with German Shepherds, we think of them as being, you know, on the one hand, these very strong, noble, the most wolf-like of all dogs, and yet they also are notorious for having hip dysplasia and other kinds of issues about walking, difficulty walking. So why is that?
Well, what happened in the 1950s, as far as I could determine, was that German Shepherd breeders, or at least some of them, started taking the classic-looking German Shepherd, which had a straight back, which was a herding dog, and started breeding it for a low-slung black back end to give it what was called a flying trot in the show ring, this trot where the dog's back end is low and it's following its handler around the ring. This, unfortunately, has become a very common look in many German Shepherds, and as you said, it leads to a great deal of hip dysplasia, an ill-formed hip and socket joint, which eventually cripples the dog. Now, this is something that was a totally human decision, a cosmetic decision, and people can certainly avoid German Shepherds whose parents look like that and still choose puppies from the classic straight-back German Shepherd.
Now, that says something to me that's kind of jolting about breeding animals so that they perform well in the show ring, but thinking about how dogs have developed alongside humans, mainly as work dogs and as companions, there's something about the conceit of having a show dog that is nothing more than a bauble, you know, for your own self-esteem and prestige. Mm-hmm. That is, to me, really a form of animal cruelty. I wonder what you think about that.
Well, I tend to agree with you, and I think that many show dogs are, in some ways, extensions of their people's egos, and highly competitive drives. And unfortunately, the judging of show dogs has gone down this slippery slope where if, say, for example, a pug had a quarter inch shorter nose than the previous pug, that was the dog who was going to get it. And you can see that incrementally, this has led to, for example, pugs who have no snouts at all. There are some people in the show world who are trying to change this by changing how judging is done, and the British Kennel Club has been in the lead in this regard, and last year instituted veterinary checks for best of breed in its dog shows. And if veterinarians said, well, yeah, the judge awarded this dog a blue ribbon, but in fact it can't breed or it can't walk, we're disqualifying it. I think this is a very important step, one that ought to be adopted by the American Kennel Club here in the United States, and it would be much like a doping check for an athlete, whereby if an athlete was found to have won with illegal means, the athlete's disqualified. The more of that kind of oversight, veterinary oversight, that we have in the dog show world, I think slowly we can reverse this century-long trend to get dogs whom, as you said, are baubles instead of fit and athletically fine-tuned specimens.
Well, let's talk about the other notoriously overbred dog, which is the Golden Retriever. And the dog I'm petting right now is, she's part flat-coated retriever, which I didn't know much about this breed until I was looking for Karina, and learned that this is the breed that actually Golden Retrievers were bred from, I do believe, and that flat-coated retrievers were sort of ignored as Golden Retrievers became a lot more popular. And it was fortunate for the flat-coated retrievers because they didn't suffer the kind of inbreeding that Golden Retrievers have experienced. I have some neighbors who love Goldens, and they're about to get, I don't know, their fourth Golden since I've been neighbors with them for 20 years. And the first dog they had when they moved into our neighborhood lived to be 13, 14 years old, but they've had a succession of dogs since then who have died very young, and they've all gotten them from the same breeder. This time around, they're getting a new dog soon, and they're going to a different breeder, and the dog that they're getting this time is going to be bred from a British Golden Retriever line as opposed to the American Golden Retriever lines, because they learned that, in fact, there's some serious issues. But I want to talk about what happened to Golden Retrievers so that they become so prone to so many illnesses.
Well, back in the 1970s, there were three champion Goldens, two show dogs and one field trial dog, who won a lot of blue ribbons. They had wonderful personalities, and many people in both the field trial and show dog world wanted these dogs to the genes to come into their line. And so they were bred to quite a bit, and they became what is called a popular sire. They were bred so many times that their genes are now meeting many times as their descendants are bred. These three dogs have several hundred thousand descendants in the United States alone. And those three dogs, it is thought, may have had a propensity for cancer, and these cancer genes are now meeting repeatedly. To be fair, you can't say that any one dog had a particular cancer gene, but whenever you use just three sires like that, the chances that both their good and bad traits down the road are going to meet more and more frequently, and that's what I think, and many other people think, is at the root of Golden Retrievers having so much cancer today.
Well, let's talk about some of the other issues where things that we would never do with human beings, well, except for the royal families, of course, they're great examples of inbreeding. But generally, inbreeding, I think, is actually forbidden in the Bible. You know, it's like the taboo against incest is like very, very old. And yet we don't seem to have any problem with having incestuous relationships for our dogs to be bred. But there's other issues where where there's also been for a long time a real double standard about how we as humans take care of ourselves and how we take care of our dogs. And for many years, I wondered why I was eating organic food and, you know, living a very healthy lifestyle and only seeing alternative medical practitioners and doing herbal remedies and naturopathic remedies. And yet I take my dog to an allopathic vet and who basically would treat the dog either with antibiotics or steroids, depending on what the problem was. And finally, about 20 years ago, I started seeing my first naturopathic vet, and it was a wonderful thing to be able to shift to the same paradigm for my animals that I had for myself. But what, why is it that it's been so much harder for us to move in the directions of health awareness for our animals than it has been for ourselves and our own bodies?
Well, I think for one, it's a commonly held attitude that dogs are, well, just dogs, and we simply don't give them the care and regard that we give to people. And this starts when, as you say, in their care, and it then goes all the way up to our ability to simply euthanize dogs if they become a little lame. We would never do that to people. However, as you point out, that is changing, and there are more integrative, holistic, naturopathic vets, call them what you will. There is more organic food for dogs, and there are more chiropractic, homeopathic remedies available to them so they can get the kind of care that people who are proactive about their own health are giving themselves and their families.
Well, I was just actually on the web the other day, and I came across something about Natura dog food. There was a recall for salmonella, so I was trying. I said, "That sounds familiar. I'm gonna, you know, check and see what Natura is." So sure enough, Natura makes Anova and Evo, which were two brands I used to feed my dog, and I started feeding them Anova because I found out that IMES wasn't very good, and I started feeding them IMES because I found out that Science Diet wasn't really that good. And fortunately, it's been a long time since my animals have eaten Anova, but it seems that in this movement towards there being, quote, healthier dog food, that a lot of the healthy dog food is still kind of a sham. And I have a vet, actually he's moved to Southern Oregon now, but I had a vet who was very adamant about raw food diets, and I tried that with my animals, and unfortunately they haven't really taken to it. And we've found a alternative, which is giving them kibble that's coated with a raw food enzyme, and they're thriving. And I have a lot of respect for the raw food diet as an option, and also that it's important for dogs to get raw bones, real bones. But let's talk a little bit about this debate about whether animals, dogs and cats, should be eating raw food versus kibble. My vet, who's down in Southern Oregon, used to call that kitty crack. So what are your thoughts about that, and how have you, the difference between the way you're raising Pucca now and the way that you raised your last dog, Merle?
Okay. Well, let's begin by saying that when we talk about dogs, again, we default to saying we want to find the one diet that's perfect for all dogs. But dogs are just as much individuals as people are, as we are. And only the zealous or the ideologically motivated would say that one diet is perfect for all human beings. It just isn't so. Likewise, I believe that dogs are individuals, and we need to find the best diet for our individual dogs. You stated it very well. You tried to feed your dogs a raw food diet. They didn't do well on it. They seem to be doing well with kibble that's coated with raw food enzymes. That's a great example. Today, unlike in the dark ages of dog food, when I had Merle as early as the early 1990s, we have a great variety of choices. We can get kibble that has no grain in it. We can get dehydrated raw food. We can get frozen raw food. We can get frozen raw food that has organic vegetables in it and that is made from free-range livestock. And I'm a great believer in people rotating their dogs through a variety of foods, seeing what they do best on, and then not simply settling for that and feeding their dog that food for the rest of their lives, but continuing to rotate. Why? In this way, you're hedging your bets against feeding your dog the same heavy metals or pollutants that can be even in the best of dog foods.
Actually, I was reading a recall for the variety of dog food that I'm giving my animals now, or both the dog and the cat food, and it's had no salmonella recalls, and it's does pretty well. But they had a recall for cat food last year because there were pieces of plastic in it, and actually at that time I thought there were pieces of plastic in this one bag of kibble that I had, but I brought it to the pet food store and figured out that it was actually parts of the feathers of that were not processed well when they were the chicken meal, which was kind of pretty gross, and it gave you a sense of, well, this food is kind of like sausage making. This is who knows what's in this food. I've never had another problem with that with this particular brand of food again. But I thought the fact that bits of plastic got into their kibble makes you wonder. You know, did you spend any time in pet food factories to kind of see what the processes are?
I did. In fact, I visited the Evo factory, and this was before it was owned by Procter & Gamble. And I found it to be an amazingly clean, almost laboratory-like facility with guys in white coats and white hard hats, quality control, the individual products being examined and tested before they were allowed into the factory, lots of quality control, and yet that dog food was had a salmonella recall recently. Is that because it's now owned by a big corporation and it's no longer under small management? Or did something slip through the cracks? I don't know. I can say, as I wrote in the book, that when I visited the facility, it seemed like an excellent food-producing plant you could have eaten off the floor, as it was so clean.
And however, and I guess Evo is grain-free, but I know that Innova, which was their little less expensive line, was still pretty conventional kibble, even though I don't remember even if it's organic. But it was better quality kibble than Purina, but certainly not the quality of kibble that I'm giving my dogs right now.
Right. And you asked me what Pukka eats as opposed to Merle. Well, Merle, when I met Merle on the San Juan River, he was a half-wild stray, it was 1991, and the vet to whom I took Merle in Jackson Hole to get his initial vaccinations and check up recommended Science Diet, and back then I didn't know any different, and I fed him Science Diet, and pretty soon he was itching like crazy. We then took him off a dog food that had corn as its primary ingredient, and presto, his itching was very much reduced. That was my first introduction to what corn can do to some dogs. These days, Pukka eats wild game, elk that I get each year, and antelope and deer, and upland birds, in addition to a frozen raw food diet that's AFCO certified, has lots of organic ingredients, free-range chicken, free-range turkey, free-range lamb. And he also eats a dry elk product that comes from New Zealand. And he eats off the table. You know, every time I make a salad or saute some vegetables, Pukka eats broccoli and cauliflower and red peppers, and he likes olives, and he's a very eclectic eater. And many vets would say, gosh, that's awful, you're feeding him table scraps. But indeed, the veterinary literature shows that dogs who eat green leafy and orange-yellow vegetables often have lower incidences of cancer. So Pukka gets his raw vegetables.
Yeah, actually, I used to give my dogs leftover salad, but we've been putting raisins in our salad for the last couple of years.
And not good, yeah.
And not good, so it's too... And actually, I'm starting to think of talking to you. Maybe we should stop putting the raisins in the salad, because dogs really love greens, I've discovered. Mm-hmm. And carrots is one of their favorite things. Well, let's talk a bit about vaccination, because you just sort of mentioned you got Merle vaccinated, but I know that you... that's another place where you've probably... had a change of heart over the between dogs as far as what kinds of vaccinations are necessary?
Absolutely. And it's not only that I've had a change of heart, is that we've also learned that the duration of immunity for the four core canine virus vaccines, rabies, distemper, parvo, and adenovirus 2, are far longer than we previously imagined. They're 7 to 15 years, depending on the strain. And so if the duration of immunity is that long, why go to the expense and risk of vaccinating a dog every 3 years, which is the current recommendation, if the dog is already protected? Therefore, instead of vaccinating a dog, you can give it a blood test called a titer and see if it still has immunity to the diseases against which it has been vaccinated. If it does, no need to revaccinate it. You can keep giving the dog titers to see if it has immunity. Then if the dog loses its immunity, you can get a booster shot. The reason to do this is that vaccines are not benign. And the veterinary literature is replete with instances of adverse reactions to vaccines, everything from welts to arthritis to fatal anemias.
Well, we've been talking a lot about the differences between the way we've traditionally treated our animals in terms of their health and our own bodies. But now I want to get to an area where there's similarities, and that has to do in the home environment. And I this is where I think your book alarmed me more than any other part, was some of the issues about, well, we were familiar with phthalates and BPA and all kinds of stuff that's in our environment that we didn't used to think about, and the prevalence of it in any kind of plastic material. So let's talk about some of the potential problems and concerns that we should have about things that we bring into our dog's home environment.
Yeah, probably the simplest one is just to look at what kind of bowl your dog is drinking its water out of and eating. And if it's plastic, it would be wise to change it out to stainless steel or glass, because, as you pointed out, many forms of plastic are full of endocrine-disrupting phthalates. Another easy solution to protect your dog from some of these common environmental toxins is to make sure that its bed is not filled with fire retardant foam. Again, those can be endocrine disruptors. You can also look at your carpets and make sure that if you bring a new carpet into the house, it's not finished with formaldehyde, a known carcinogen, which takes a year or two to off-gas, and all that time your dog is lying right on it, breathing in those carcinogenic fumes. You can also make sure or try to put a water filtration device on your tap. It'll take out heavy metals. If you live in a municipal area, it's likely that your water is disinfected with chlorine. Chlorine combines with nitrates. It can form carcinogenic compounds. A very inexpensive, maybe $150 to fit under kitchen sink counter, a water filtration device will take out those chemicals, and your water will taste better, and it'll be better for you and your dog.
Yeah, in fact, well, actually, here in Portland, our water is quite healthy, but it is chlorinated, and so all you need to do if you have Portland water is to get a much less expensive filter that just takes out the chlorine, because
there
the other stuff isn't in our water. So that's the other thing, is to find out, for those of you listening other parts of the country, find out what's in your water and how much you need to take it out. But I think, yeah, that's another example of like giving your dog the same kinds of care and water that we drink ourselves.
Right. And I had a very humorous example with Merle about his ability to discriminate between waters. We have a well on our land, and so Merle grew up either drinking river water when he was a puppy or drinking our well water, which is not chlorinated. And when he was a few years old, we drove down to Boulder, Colorado to see some friends. It was a really hot drive when we got there, and my friends gave me a filtered glass of water from the refrigerator, but filled the Merle's bowl. They put out a bowl for Merle from the kitchen tap, unfiltered, and I said, Merle won't drink that. It's chlorinated. And they laughed at me, saying, well, we know Merle is a discriminating dog, but this is beyond belief. So they put the water bowl down. He sniffed it. He sat down. He looked at us and with a look that said, I'm not drinking that. That's got chlorine in it. And they filled his bowl with the filtered water, and he lapped it right up.
Well, I can't say that Karina has quite this discrimination because she drinks some puddles in the Willamette River, so... she likes her filtered water as well. Well, I guess one last thing I want to talk about is dogs on leash versus dogs off leash. And just the life that you described for you and Pukka and outside of Jackson, Wyoming, sounds quite idyllic. It reminds me of a time I spent in Sayulita where I wished I had Karina with me because I was in dog heaven. You know, you live in a place where dogs can run free and sort of accepted. But a lot of people live in communities where there's leash laws and a lot of, and then in places where it's just not safe. So how do we balance a dog's need to run with the dog's need both to be a good citizen for other people and also needing to protect the dog from being hit by cars?
Yeah. As I say, people who live with dogs in cities have to be far more committed dog guardians than those of us who live in rural places where dogs can be off-leash safely. And I'm doing this interview with you, Barbara, from New York City, where I'm at a conference about dog health for the next couple of days. But even in a huge urban place like this, there are places like Central Park and Prospect Park that have off-leash hours. And Prospect Park in Brooklyn, for example, has the mile-long meadow, a fabulous place where hundreds of dogs roam off leashes under the voice command of their people, of course, and they're walked to Prospect Park on leash. I've taken dogs there for a walk, and then they're taken off leash. And so I think that dog guardians in urban places have to be a little bit more creative in trying to find spots where their dogs can exercise and play with other dogs at dog speed off leash. Certainly, I'm not condoning that we simply take dogs off leashes everywhere that we live with dogs. That is a clear impossibility. It's unsafe for the dogs. And certainly Pukka walks on a leash when we go to Jackson. And that's just part of living in a suburban and urban environment.
Well, one other issue that I've had with myself, actually, because I used to, my first dog was one of these dogs. We do a lot of hiking around Mount Hood and other wild areas in Oregon and in the Northwest. And my first dog, who grew up in the country, would just run up and down ridges, and she would put about 10 miles on for every mile that I hiked. And
right.
My next dog, partly by nature and partly by my own consciousness, stayed on the trail. With Karina, who I think would be like the first dog because she's a real natural climber and adventurer, but I trained her to stay on trails, whether we're out in the woods or whether we're in the wetland wildlife habitat near our house, that I think that it's important for dog owners to recognize that their dogs are not part of the wildlife ecosystem of wild places that we like to go in, and that there's also limits we need to put on our dogs. And I wonder how you relate to Pukka when you're out in the wild and how close do you keep him to you?
Well, as I point out in the book, I spent a lot of time with Pukka when he was a puppy, training him not to chase wildlife. And initially, for his first year, he was quite good at that. But when he became a teenager, he started chasing deer and bison and elk again. And I spent months using a gentle leader and a long length of a lunge line that I use on my horses to try and break him of that habit, using a lot of positive reinforcement. And eventually, as I relate in the book, it simply didn't work, and I resorted to an e-stim collar to break him of the habit, and it did so rather quickly. He needed, as I said, 13-tenths of a second shocks to dissuade him to chase deer and the other big mammals that live around our house. I've been taken to task for doing that, for people who think e-collars are absolutely horrible. But if you're going to have a dog that is going to be off-leash and you want to be a responsible citizen and not have the dog chasing wildlife and the dog simply won't learn any other way, then maybe that's the small price that the dog needs to pay to have its freedom. This is a highly controversial issue. I'm sure some people are nodding their heads and other people are ready to string me up.
And actually, Ted, we're just about out of time. So on this note, I think we have to end. But I want to thank you very much for joining us. And my dog, Karina, has very much appreciated this conversation as well. So thanks for joining us, and maybe we'll talk again sometime.
Thank you very much, Barbara, for having me.
Sure. We've been talking with Ted Carasotti, who's author of Pooka's Promise, The Quest for Longer-Lived Dogs, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO's Community Radio. If you're just tuning in, you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon at our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, Hood River writer and environmentalist Steve Hawley will be back to talk about his new blog about salmon. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Kate Welch. We're listening to some music by John Hyatt. Thanks for listening. But I could have gone that extra mile for an extra bark or an extra smile. 'Cause I never felt so free. It was just my dog and me. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Lori Sonnenfeld, presenting singer-songwriter Joanne Rand in a concert of original psychedelic, folk, environmental, and earth-based spirituality music, Friday, April 26th at 7:30 p.m. at Bamboo Grove, Southeast 2nd and Taylor. Details and videos at CascadiaHomes.com/community.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
It's Earth Day. We will hear about environmental issues all day today until 7 p.m. when we will hear all natural sounds until 7 a.m. tomorrow. Coming up next, Chris Andre welcomes local activist Mark Lakeman of City Repair to talk about the hunter-gatherer path. And at 11:30, Stephanie Potter interviews Christine Bile about her recent book, Dirt Work, An Education in the Woods. Then at noon, Kathleen Stevenson interviews Adam Rome, author of The Genius of Earth Day, how a 1970 teach-in unexpectedly made the first green generation. At 12:30, Joe Meyer hosts an update on the upcoming vote asking Portlanders to approve a plan to fluoridate the city's water. At 1, Joe Clement hosts an excerpt from the series Against the Grain, in which C.S. Song interviews Stephen Vogel, author of Against Nature, The Concept of Nature in Critical Theory. At 1:45, Jimmy Tardy looks at Portland's celebration of World Environmental Day coming up June 5th, and the 6 weeks between Earth Day and World Environment Day. At 2, Paul Rowland interviews John Stober, longtime activist, investigative reporter, and author. They discuss Stober's beginnings and history as an activist, from protesting the Vietnam War and organizing a teach-in at his high school on the first Earth Day in 1970. And yes, you are tuned to KBOO in Portland. And I have Chris Andre ready. Hi, Chris.
Yeah, good morning, Kate. Thanks so much for engineering the shows this morning. It's Earth Day, of course, here at KBOO and around the world. We are going to be speaking today with Mark Lakeman, who is the moving force behind City Repair, and, of course, the One of the principal organizers of Village Repair Convergence. It's Village Building Convergence 2013, and the theme this year is succession. This has been so much a part of Portland for so long. It's something embraced by the entire community in many and various ways. Sometimes it seems that the ways in which Portland responds to when people become involved in a village building convergence project, what I think often happens is that there are unforeseen outcomes, because what they're actually doing is whatever a group is engaged together in creating, they're creating more than the project. They're creating a sense of community. They are creating a network of people meeting face to face. Yeah, okay, online, of course, but really face to face, when you work together, shoulder to shoulder, getting your hands dirty, painting an intersection, which would be the quintessential, of course, a VBC project, or a building a notice board or a carb bench and oven, that kind of thing. You get your hands dirty together, you create something, and there it is. You could actually see it. It's a very different thing than writing a blog. It's something permanent that exists in the world, and you can refer back to it. This is how we create urban ley lines across our landscape. We'll have Mark joining. Mark will be joining us momentarily. We will be, during the course of this program, taking calls from listeners. The number to call is 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187 if you'd like to join this discussion. The fact that this year's theme is succession is of great interest to me. I have a farm. It started out, when I first had it, extremely poisoned. It was had been run according to the